Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Friday morning. It is the 18th of August, and it's a rainy Friday.
Good.
I just think that puts everything into perspective, doesn't it?
I like rain, but...
Well, yeah, it's a rain. You can take that however you want to. It's the Friday before the big eclipse. That's what it is. Well, good morning. Welcome. Let me introduce the group to you, and then we'll get started. We have a lot to talk about. We have wonderful panelists, and we will start our discussion. We certainly don't want to leave you out. God knows we don't want to leave you out. All you have to do to write to us is go to panel@wamc.org. That's where you can write to us, panel@wamc.org. We just ask you to be short and to the point because we want to read as many letters as we possibly can. A lot of people like to write 4, 5, 8, 12, 175 times in a morning. Don't do that. Write once, and then you collect your thoughts, write your thought down, and then you're done for the day.
Briefly.
Right. And then, if you have more thoughts, then try to get a radio program. I think it's very nice. If you can get your own radio show and then say whatever you want. That's great.
Or you can tweet.
You can tweet.
That's right. You can tweet. You can blog. You can do all kinds of things. There's many other options.
Talk to a neighbor.
Pen pal. So we thank you very much for that and for adhering to the rules. Panel@wamc.org. You get people during the day and say, well, why didn't you read my letter? I said, well, you know, you didn't write to the right place and you didn't follow the rules.
I also say to people when they say, why didn't you read my letter? I always say, do you know how many letters we get a day?
Yeah, we get a lot.
We may get 500 to 1,000 letters a day.
Really?
So, yeah.
That's excellent, but hard to manage.
And by the way, this is sort of off the point, but let me just also say that it is concerning or at least puzzling when people write at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and then wonder why their letter wasn't read on the air. And we're like, oh, well, the show's over.
Yeah, no. These are called preemptive letters.
Oh, you think so?
Yeah, of course. And some of them say that. But what we do here, of course, is we have our own ground rules, but perhaps we should tell you what the rules are. You should write during the program.
Yeah, during the show. We look at everything eventually, but if you want to actually be on the show, we kind of look at from the core hours of what we're talking about. Anyway, let me introduce the panelists. That's the important part. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here fresh from, maybe not fresh, but he's fresh from the debate last night, which was great. I listened to it. It was fantastic. It aired here, the Albany Democratic primary debate, and you were great.
It was our Ian Pickus who did all the hard work. He was the news director. He's the news director. He had everything timed out. He had Benita Zahn, who he worked very closely with, on one side. He had me, and he kept saying, "Okay," he would write down what I had to say. So I did what I was told. And he did a great job. He's wonderful. One other thing, Joe, while we're on the scene of introducing me, I have in front of me today's Albany Times Union, of course, the major newspaper in this city.
Yes.
In fact, I don't know of any others. It says here, a couple of Donahues, and it's a huge, huge, look at this, gang.
Yeah, it's really nice.
A huge story, Times Union honoring our Joe. WAMC host says, persistence led to shot interviewing a broadcast idol, a huge picture of Phil Donahue. And Joe, you're getting the recognition from the Times Union that you absolutely deserve.
Thank you. It's the nicest thing that Tio has written about me all week. The article is about an interview that we did with Phil Donahue, which is going to air at 10:30 this morning. So I hope you can listen to it. We're pretty proud of it, and my thanks to Sarah LaDuke for working so hard with me to put it together. And
I think we're doing at 1 o'clock today. We're doing the mayoral debate.
That's right. 1 o'clock, we have a repeat of the debate.
And Joe, how long did it take for you to get the interview with Phil Donahue?
It took a couple of months, It was... but I've been sort of working on it on and off for a couple of years. But he was telling me there's some people, and it's quoted in the article there, but there are a couple... some people... He said that there had been people trying to get him for 12 or 13 years. He just doesn't like doing it in that extent.
So now we know what to get you for your birthday, one of the Elizabeth Warren T-shirts. He persisted.
I'd wear that. Well, let me introduce you to the rest of the gang here. We also have, and we feel very, very lucky to have all of our wonderful panelists. But Judith Enck is here, former regional administrator of Region 2 of the EPA. And Judith, thank you very much. Very nice to have
you
here.
Good morning. Great
thank
to be
you.
Here.
A hero of our listenership. Judith Enck has no peer in terms of environmental qualifications. And I fully expect that when a Democrat is elected a few years from now, she's going to be the administrator of the EPA.
Oh, gee. Thanks, Alan. Get to put that back together again. The Humpty Dumpty job on steroids.
Not that you necessarily want that, but there you go. Oh, you shivered. also with us is a professor of economics at Siena College. He's also the chair of the business department at that institution. And I would note the alma mater of the Phil Donahue in my life, my dad. So welcome to the show.
Thanks very much
for being here.
No, I don't get that. What do you mean your dad?
My father, Phil Donahue. Phil Donahue.
I get it now.
Who is not the one I'll be interviewing for a couple of reasons. One being that my dad is dead. But anyway, what did I bring down the room? Sorry. Yeah. What, too soon?
Yeah. Awkward.
I forgot what I was going to say.
Professor, New York City.
Your beloved dad went to Siena College.
Yeah, went to Siena College. Yeah, yeah. Class of 1950, I believe, with William Kennedy.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, very nice. And we are pleased to welcome Frankie Bailey, who is with us. She is a professor in the School of Criminal Justice at the University of Albany. She is also a noted and wonderful, wonderful, wonderful mystery writer. And if you've never read her novels, you have to. They are just terrific. And what was the last one, The Red Queen? Is that the...
What the Fly Saw.
What the Fly Saw.
Thank you. I should have you as my publicist.
Great. Really great stuff. So we're thrilled to have Frankie on the program.
It's an honor to be here.
We've been trying... I think you've been on the program maybe once before. So it's very nice to have you back on the...
Not on the panel, but I've been in for interviews a few times.
So Frankie, say, the name of the latest book is?
What the Fly Saw.
What the Fly Saw. I have to get over to our wonderful independent bookstore in Great Barrington, the book loft, to get it before. Every time Joe mentions anything here, the line forms in the rear.
And books are just flying off the shelf.
No, it's true.
But the Fly Saw. We meet, there's a detective, Hannah McCabe, in that book, and it's just great. It's really, really fun.
Set in Albany in the near future.
Set in Albany.
Great.
So
let's run to
Market
Block
good
Books.
Good stuff. That's right. An independent near you. So let's talk. We've got stuff going on, and we want to thank you for being with us again and panel at WAMC.org. Let's get to the topics. We are going to start with Barcelona. Alan and I were talking about this earlier. It's tough to really say anything on this other than the horrible tragedy that it is, and ultimately what we know at this moment. The terrorist strike in Spain killed 14, and the New York Times is going to make me log in right now. Did you all see this one? You have to now put all the pictures of window blinds in to verify.
What do you mean?
There we go. Uh-oh. So they have the thing to make sure you're not a robot.
Right.
Yeah, it's great for when you're on the radio. Anyway, so 14 killed in Barcelona. Attacks are the nation's deadliest in a decade. Driver of a van, two vehicle assaults in Barcelona in a seaside resort town came after the Spanish authorities had been warning of an impending attack for some time. The Islamic State claimed responsibility for the attack in Barcelona, in which a van charged down a major street crowded with pedestrians. And the when you look about at what we know, we know that it happened just before 6 p.m. their time. A van jumped the curb, began speeding down the pedestrian walkway at the center of Barcelona's most famous street. It's right there.
Las Ramblas.
Las Ramblas.
Anybody in this room been there? No. I have. No. I wanted to live there. I love that place so much. It was great.
It is amazing in watching the video that the death toll is not higher. Mm. Although with that said, there are 100 people injured.
Many of them critical.
Seriously injured. So the death toll, unfortunately, is expected
So Joe, I wanted to ask Frankie, as a criminal justice professor, the real question is, what's going on in the background with searching for these people? Because apparently they've found a number of plots, which they've foiled already. What is your sense of the investigative techniques? Do you think people are being tortured here? And
well,
is it justified?
I have to say, my specialty, my area is not terrorism investigations.
Gotcha.
So I'm following the news. But yeah, my area is mass media, popular culture, American culture, and crime history. And so I'm following this in terms of media coverage. And as I look at this, as I think about it, one of the things we talk about is how terrorism and the media are connected, for better or worse, that if you can carry out an assault like this in a public place, the amount of terror that you're able to create among people who now fear being in public spaces, because it's so random.
So you see what happened just last weekend in Charlottesville with a car going down a street and used in a form of terror.
Charlottesville and that area, that mall, I walked down, and the idea of a car, I mean, there's really no place to go if it comes at you quickly enough.
We saw it in London. We saw it in Times Square in New York.
Paris.
There have been 12 major incidents around the world using trucks and cars. London Bridge, I mean, we can name them all. And it kind of raises the question for law enforcement, how do you protect against people essentially weaponizing cars and trucks?
Yeah, I mean, when you just turn around and a car is coming towards you, how do you know at that moment that this is someone behind a wheel who's about to accelerate and mow you down? It's just...
Well, one of the things that I thought about were the people who were... Now, apparently, three of these trucks were rented by a car rental agency.
Right.
Now, you would not empower people to rent uranium to people. Too dangerous. So at what level of consciousness the people who are now renting these trucks out? Now, of course, we all know they could have stolen anything they wanted and mowed people down with it. But it seems to me that you would want to be very, very careful with the people who are renting at Avis or any of these other places.
But how do you do that?
Yeah. When somebody comes in and there's a sort of sixth sense, the same way you ask our bartenders to say if somebody is drunk, or not, or shouldn't have another drink. It's not a perfect thing, but I'm not looking for anybody to blame here, but I'm talking about the future, since this now seems to be the weapon of choice for so many people.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very low-cost and efficient way to do it, and I know that sounds kind of crass, but, from an economist's perspective, it's extremely efficient, and it's very low cost, and this is probably going to be the new norm.
I hate the word efficient.
I do too.
It's efficient in creating greater terror.
Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, keeping people out of those public spaces that we need to be, have them be in to battle the psychology of terrorism.
Okay, but Professor, here's the question. If the news media becomes the, helps along with this terror, then what is the responsibility of the news media? You could not turn on. I mean, it's the one thing that shoved Trump right off the front page and became, overwhelming. So does the news media have a responsibility?
You absolutely have a responsibility to cover it. But that also, that's the problem, that if you don't cover it, you're failing in your responsibility to the public to keep us informed. If you do cover it, you're playing into the terrorist agenda in terms of creating pervasive fear. So it's a very difficult situation for the media.
And, fear largely, when people are afraid of this stuff, it divides society where it's, one group against another, and that leads to, more racist attitudes, more xenophobia, where people are sacrificing civil liberties in exchange for the perception of security. And anybody who's flown in American airports sees what TSA does, and
right.
I mean, whether or not they've that has prevented other terrorist attacks is up to question. But, you know, if other countries aren't doing the same type of airport screening, what we're doing here is really just protecting domestic flyers. And it creates fear, and that creates instability, and that creates opportunities for radical thoughts and odious ideas to spread very rapidly.
And as if the president hasn't said enough this week to make your head hurt, he tweeted on this. He had a rather conventional tweet at the beginning saying that the people of Barcelona should be tough and strong and offered the help of the United States. Then came the second tweet,
right,
which was, study what General Pershing of the United States did to terrorists when caught. There are no more radical Islamic terror for there was no more radical Islamic terror for 35 years.
It was a lie, by the way.
Well, yeah.
Never happened.
It never happened. It was he made this at an election rally in South Carolina over a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And
he said you could look it up in the history books.
And you can't.
But you can't.
And in the Philippines, conducted by General Pershing between 1909 and 1913. And so basically what he said is he caught 50 terrorists who did tremendous damage, killed many people. He took 50 terrorists. He took 50 men. He dipped 50 bullets in pig's blood. He shot 49 of those people. And the 50th person, he said, you go back to your people and tell them what happened. So his claim being that such mass executions ended the Islamic insurgency for a quarter of a century, which, again, didn't happen. But
so he lies with impunity. We know it. He gets away with it, or he has gotten away with it up to now. But it does seem that the whole deal is disassembling when, you know, former major allies, conservative allies, are in the United States Senate, which is where, by the way, sooner or later, somebody's going to have to hold up their hand and vote for impeachment. This is going to be very, very tough as he continues on this megalomaniacal way of going.
We're going to pause there. And when we come back, we'll talk about all of the other issues and associated with this, as well as what Alan just brought up and the reaction, still seeing much reaction from the president's comments earlier this week, as well as comments made yesterday. We will continue with our panel discussion. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll continue after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Judith Enk, Frankie Bailey, and Aaron Pasitti join us this morning, and we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. We have many letters like these.
That's right. Victoria writes, can you comment on the Antifa faction that arms itself with mace, sticks, rocks, etc., and then engages with the alt-right demonstrators? This happened in Charlottesville, the probable source of his alt-left comment. Can you imagine what would have happened in the civil rights movement if we had used violence on those bigots? Black Panthers didn't do that well with violence either. This is a problem, don't you think? Vicky in Nova Scotia.
Nova Scotia, cool.
So I take offense to the Antifa label in that, you know, you have to be labeled as anti-fascist. Isn't that just the norm for 99% of the population? So that being said, you know, the radical elements of that group normally engage in property damage, not necessarily physical violence.
So is that a defense of them?
It's when you have giant protests with competing sides who are at, you know, I mean, really opposed to one another, there's going to be violence. This isn't the first time that's happened at a protest. It's the mowing down of innocent people, innocent protesters. That is the issue.
You know, I am so old that I remember the civil rights marches that we were on and all the other things that we went to Washington for. And boy, there were a lot of marshals there who knew that if there was going to be violence, which is certainly not what Dr. King was preaching, certainly not what Gandhi was preaching, that was going to become the story. And now we go to Frankie and her expertise in terms of what becomes the story.
I think the story becomes, however, they're the witnesses to the actual event and their ability to get their versions of the stories out, and they're the various media outlets presenting the story as some very... So there are competing narratives, that's what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
There is no one story. There's the competing narratives about the event and what you believe about that based on where you choose to get your information.
Yes, well, no, that's true, but if somebody throws a Molotov cocktail... kills somebody or hurts somebody.
That becomes the story. But then you still will have people making some argument about why that happened, and the why becomes the story. And there are always going to be defenders of that person who did that.
Yeah.
So most people say if you mow people down in a car, that should be the story, and the most important story. But the people who are trying to deflect attention from the people who were in Charlottesville, the neo-Nazis and the others, are trying to make you this idea that it's like arguing that if you're involved, and I hate making this comparison because it's not the right analogy, but it's the only one that comes to mind at this time in the morning. But if you're involved in domestic violence and a husband's beating the wife and he has a stick and the wife picks up something and hits him, that you argue that it's mutual violence. But I mean, it's a question of self-defense. I don't know who was defending what, but if there's mutual violence going on there may be stories that we don't know about each blow and who is giving the blow and why. And disentangling that is really complicated.
Well, you know, it does seem to me that you enhance Trump's narrative when you throw a Molotov cocktail.
Yeah.
Or when you do. And I mean, we always, as white liberals, and that of course doesn't include you, but as white liberals, when we went on those marches, we knew that if you messed up, and look at all of the heroes on the Selma Bridge, for example, who knew that they could not fight back. They couldn't do that. That really, you know, it was pretty dramatic just to sit down and let the police dogs at you, which they did.
It's a moral high ground at that point where I grew up in Danville, Virginia, which is just across the border from Greensboro, North Carolina. I don't remember the march as well. I don't remember the set-ins. I remember when Martin Luther King came to town, and I was up in a balcony looking down, didn't understand what was going on. But he did lead a march through town, and the police did provide protection while it was going on. But then later on, there was an incident, and so not involving the marchers who were nonviolent, but I think there's a kind of evolution over time in the civil rights movement from Dr. King to Malcolm X and to finally the Black Panthers in terms of how they perceive the necessity of using violence or self-defense or proactive violence in terms of what they're doing.
As a student, though, of the history of the way in which it goes and it went, then what happens when it goes from nonviolence to Black Panthers who may say, we have to fight back. We have to be physical here.
You lose the moral high ground, right. Yeah. I think.
It changes the media narrative.
Because now you can focus on those people using violence.
Even if it's in the minority. I mean, I think the media has been doing a very good job covering this, what I would call an American tragedy, but the mainstream media, MSM, does tend to focus on whenever there's a violent interaction, and then there's no sense of how proportional it is.
But who would have thought, right? Maybe I'm talking too much, but who would have thought that Charlottesville would be the undoing, the whoosh, that moment of tipping for a presidency? Because there are an awful lot of people yesterday who were saying, this is the end. This is the end.
We've said that before, though. Yeah.
No, they've said it before, but not this dramatically.
This definitely feels different. And I think one reason, and who I think the real media heroine is this week, is Elle Reeve,
yes.
The young Vice news reporter. Mm-hmm. And I know this is, everyone has heard this all week, but I really want to make a plea for people to do something this weekend. Watch the Vice video from start to finish, and then immediately watch Trump's Tuesday news conference. Don't read it. Watch it.
And how do you do it? How do you get it?
You go to the Vice News website.
Well, if you just put in Vice News Charlotte, so it comes
it'll,
right
it'll
up.
It'll pop up.
It'll come right up. And then same with the Trump press conference. That is, yes, That's a good assignment, Judith.
I'm being very maternal, but you have to watch it in that order. You have to watch the Vice News presentation, which is amazing and reminds us of how well organized.
It's a film.
Yeah, it's a short documentary. I don't want to use that word because people will think it's too long. I think it's only a half hour. But it is
20 minutes,
right. It is amazing, and it covers what unfolded in a way that no other media outlet has.
To Alan's point about is this a tipping point for the Trump presidency, he's done some crazy things and has said some crazy things, but now he's saying things that are legitimately un-American and that run in total contrast to some very core American values going back to the founding fathers. And now we have an un-American president. And what do you do with an un-American president?
Who is basically defending Nazis, mm-hmm. of all things, Nazis.
And white supremacists.
That's entirely un-American and unacceptable.
You know what what music I've been listening to all week? Pete Seeger's song, Which Side Are You On?
Oh, it's great.
Which is about unions, mm-hmm. but so relevant, after Tuesday's news conference and the taking sides.
You may not know it, but that is one of our anthems here at WAMC.
I do not know that.
And in fact, Natalie Merchant gave us a concert. And she sang that song.
Oh.
I don't think there was a dry eye in that dry eye in the house. And what was particularly great about it is she allowed me to play the banjo behind her.
Oh.
And I could hardly keep up.
Wow. And Ani DiFranco has a great kind of updated lyrics version.
Oh, yeah.
So that will sustain us as we deal with this agony.
Billy Bragg has a version too, which is highly recommended.
Oh, there we
That's great.
Okay. Let's go to a couple letters in between. Yes.
Yeah, Karen says, please share your seasoned perspective on the proposed fracked oil shale Pilgrim Pipeline project in any relevant context, e.g. DAPL. Well, that's another thing. You're not allowed to use initials.
Dakota Access Pipeline.
What'd you say? Yeah, Dakota Access Pipeline, right. Scott Pruitt, current fossil fuel markets, Trump's Paris withdrawal, et cetera. Thanks for having her. I guess that's you. As a guest today, Miriam from New Paltz. And P.S., for your information, Solarize New York is going strong, as are Rosendale Citizens for Local Power and the New Paltz Climate Action Coalition. That's for you to comment.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. So I think Governor Cuomo did an excellent thing by banning hydrofracking in New York State. However, fossil fuel infrastructure is being installed all over New York that would bring fracked gas from Pennsylvania into New York, a number of different pipelines, a number of different power plants. And I appreciate the fact that many of the environmental advocates who said no to fracking are now focused on this fossil fuel infrastructure.
And are willing to go to jail for it, by the way.
Yes, including some high-profile actors and advocates. And
a 95-year-old.
Yes,
person.
In Massachusetts. Yeah. That was inspiring. The problem is, if you build the pipeline, the gas will come. And these are expensive pipelines and gas-fired power plants. And so, the next stage in this analysis of why we don't want fossil fuels is, locally focusing on these threats.
And this, of course, as the Region 2 administrator, you know all too well, that there were people within the Democratic Party and other places,
yes.
including a president at some point, who said, okay, go ahead with this.
Well, Ed Rendell from Pennsylvania, the former governor. I mean, there are a lot of, it's a revolving door in Democratic circles where they go from elected office and then they get high-paying gigs promoting the fossil fuel industry. And I will say during the Obama administration, the president in his second term did support hydrofracking as a, quote, bridge fuel. I would argue it's a bridge to nowhere. We can skip that and go right to renewables. California, on many days, gets 40% of their electricity from solar.
The interesting thing about fracking is that the rise of fracking has lowered the cost of natural gas, which is exactly what has been hurting the coal industry, which has been one of Trump's big bases. And he's just latched on to, we're bringing coal jobs back. Well, if you increase fracking, which I don't think is a good idea, that's going to further reduce coal employment.
Yeah.
That's not environmental regulations. It's the fact that there's cheaper fuels and technology that makes coal way less efficient.
We need to take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We have many more letters. We have more letters where those came from, and we'll read them right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to our roundtable panel for this Friday morning. Very nice to have you with us. Let us go back to letters.
Okay. Where is the outrage and moral leadership from evangelical leaders for Trump's Charlottesville comments? These charlatans and their silence about Trump and Charlottesville are shameful. They only care about Neil Gorsuch's appointment to the Supreme Court. I'm just going to read those couple of lines because otherwise the letter's too long. And Alan says, asking Rent-A-Car to be a frontline becomes racial profiling. What they could do is deeper screening, possibly cross-reference with a federal database, etc. It can't happen with the clerk's eyes, only the paperwork. It's Alan, you certainly make a good point, about that. You have to be very careful. But I still think you have to be careful when something like this is happening. Anybody disagree?
I don't disagree. I just don't think it's going to work. I think that they will steal cars.
Yes,
and,
no question.
And then you have the rental places in a position of having to make judgments, and college kids can't move on weekends. I think every business sector has a role to play in preventing terrorist attacks and extremism, but we're in deep trouble here, where we've got cars and trucks being weapons, and I just they'll buy one.
Those cars don't need to be rented.
Easy enough to steal one.
Can buy one on Craigslist.
Yeah. I mentioned steal one early in this discussion. Right. We know it's not that hard. Okay, so Gary says, "Hi, panel."
Hello.
Hello, Gary.
Good morning.
Trump should be asked if he would support statutes commemorating U.S. Army generals who denounce the federal government, take up arms against the government, are directly responsible for the deaths of American citizens. These men were all traitors. We don't have Benedict Arnold statues here in upstate New York. Thank you, says Gary. James says, don't most English streets have those concrete pillars along the roadside walks due to narrow widths of the streets or the cities? Maybe more of those should be implemented. At least they would stop or limit these attacks on people in the sidewalks. You know, if you've been on Las Ramblas, I'll tell you right now, there's no room. I mean, people are in the street. They're on the sidewalks. It is one of the most popular places in America, and they knew it. And by the way, if you walk in Manhattan right now, you will see in front of some of the Jewish institutions, for example, you'll see these concrete barriers up there because people know that they are targets.
Right. And all the federal buildings and I just don't think there is a way to protect. I mean, this is why law enforcement is so worried about this.
Not unless we're spending 100% of our GDP on preventing these attacks, they're going to continue.
Although, Aaron, you could spend the money on that rather than the wall.
True.
The
wall.
You know, it's interesting about the wall. I don't want to go in that direction, but it is fascinating that where that looked like a sure thing. In the beginning, it sure doesn't look that way now.
Although there's a lot of money in the proposed federal budget.
Yeah.
Mexico obviously is not going to pay for the wall, but Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell is going along with billions of dollars to get the wall started.
Well, I wouldn't want to be.
Do they really do it now, though?
I'm not sure now. That is a really good point, Frankie. I think maybe they'll stand up to the president more.
Sure. Every time he alienates another one of them. You know, that's somebody else. They don't need that many votes. They're only two votes behind.
Right.
So there you are. Victoria says, can you comment, didn't we do that, on the Antifa
faction?
Yeah, we did that one.
Nova Scotia.
Okay. Representative Steve Cohn will introduce articles of impeachment. Well, you know, he won't be the first. These have been introduced all along.
What about censure?
By Democrats.
We're hearing about censure.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about the censure resolution that's going in this morning by Congressmember Jerry Nadler.
Yeah, one of the most radical Democrats in the House of Representatives.
And Bonnie Watson Coleman, a very articulate African-American congresswoman from New Jersey, who I had the pleasure of working with a little bit on environmental issues. I think censure is really appropriate here. Some would argue, you know, what's the legal significance? Right. It's kind of a letter of reprimand, but it will become a historical document.
It's how they got Joe McCarthy.
Yep, and also these Republicans who are starting to speak out. So, for instance, I called my Congress member 2 days ago about the censure
resolution.
Who is your
Congress member?
It's John Faso. I'm a regular caller, and the young staff that pick up the phone are lovely. And although I'm not sure they always write down what we're calling about, maybe it's just me. But I said,
but you're an impressive person in that you have a lot of status.
I just say I'm Judith from Post and Kill, and I think. What Faso's staff said, well, he emphatically disagrees with what the president has done. And I said, well, that's good, but that's not enough. What is he going to do? He needs to co-sponsor and vote for this censure resolution. It's being introduced this morning, and Republicans in particular have to decide what side are they on.
Yes, and if you want to be reelected, if John Faso wants to be reelected, because of his vote on
healthcare,
mm-hmm. he's now at the end of the line. And, you know, if he wants to be reelected, he's got to do a real big jump to the front of the line.
And this should not be difficult. If you're standing up against Nazis and white supremacists, go on record. Don't just tweet it. Do something.
You know, I'm very astounded that there hasn't been more done with the local representatives and where they are on this. It's one thing for a staff member to say that to you. But again, back to your narrative, Professor, on question of how much does it count that a newspaper would insist, or that WMC, which has done this and called all of the offices and hoping that, you know, we can get an answer, which we cannot. I mean, Lee Stefanik is not going to give you an answer on this that makes sense. John Faso's people don't do that either. Mm-hmm. These people need to be out front if they're going to survive.
If you're going to be a leader, this is your moment. Well, Faso, I think, is doing one very controlled town hall next week in Dutchess County. And if you have to get a ticket, but he should be doing town halls, and Stefanik should be doing town halls every week on this topic and other things, and not hiding.
But I honestly think that a lot of Republican congressmen and congresswomen probably won't step up to the front lines because they're willing to tolerate that, as awful as it is, in order to get some of their larger priorities like tax reform, immigration reform passed through, and they're really just holding their nose and saying, we've got a Republican president and a Republican Congress, and these are the things we want to get through, and they're willing to tolerate that.
But Aaron, the thing they want more than anything else is to get reelected. I know these guys. I've worked with them. I know they want to get reelected. And I think that they just have a sort of what, I hate to quote him, but Marx would have called a false consciousness. You know, they think Their reality is that they're going to get away with it because they got elected in the first place.
So how possible is a censure? I mean, to have Republicans come aboard on something like this, if you put it to them and say, okay, well, all right, what do you think? What do you think on this?
I'm sorry for interrupting, but it's only whether or not Paul Ryan goes along with it. Because after all, that House of Representatives is an oligarchy. That's what it is. And if he says, no, we're not letting, and his rules committee says, no, we're not letting this come to the floor, there's no vote.
True. But I also think that more and more Republican incumbents are speaking out. I think Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee had really interesting comments yesterday where he said the president's not able to demonstrate stability or competence. He doesn't understand the character of the nation. Now, you have to understand, Corker was one of Trump's earliest supporters. He was considered for VP, for Secretary of State. I think having Corker make that statement, I think, bodes well for Republicans voting for censure.
Now, I may be wrong about this, but I think that the Corker statement was picked up on somebody's iPhone who was a group of people surrounded Corker, I think probably constituents. Corker then lets go, and I just wonder whether he was prepared for the outcome of that.
I watched it. I don't know who taped it, but thank you, whoever did. Maybe it was citizen journalism. But he was very careful and deliberate in the way he chose his words.
He started slow.
Yeah, but boy, he got there. He got there.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation and move on to other topics as well. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable for this Friday morning. Very nice to have you with us. Let me just reintroduce the panel real quick. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Judith Eng, former regional administrator of Region 2 of the EPA, otherwise known as the Environmental Protection Agency. Also, Aaron Pisidia is with us, associate professor of economics at Siena College, and Frankie Bailey, author and professor in the School of Criminal Justice, University at Law. I wanted to get to the story. We started to talk about it yesterday because it was breaking as we were on the air yesterday, and the president's tweets in regards to the monuments, and he lamented the removal of Confederate monuments as an assault on American culture and revived, I mentioned this earlier, the bogus story about General Pershing. But let us talk about the monuments for a moment. I'm going to go to Frankie Bailey. First of all, Frankie, tell us the course that you are teaching this coming semester. One of the courses is entitled
Crime and Justice in a Material Culture. It's about the objects of crime and justice.
Okay.
So we're actually starting. I hadn't intended to start with monuments, but we are starting with monuments.
So how does this fit in, and what would you, as a professor, like to teach the president?
What would I like to teach the president?
just
pick one.
Just on this particular subject.
Do you have a few hours?
Please, yes.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mentioned we were talking about I'm a Southerner, so I grew up in Danville, Virginia, the last capital of the Confederacy. So I grew up around Virginia. Actually, the Southern Poverty Law Center did a study of monuments, and Virginia has more Confederate monuments than any other state in the Union. And so I grew up in a place where the Sutherland Mansion was actually the last capital of the Confederacy. And so I grew up with a Confederate or a cemetery that had soldiers from the Civil War. So, but I think monuments, the symbolism is so interesting. And you know, there's this whole Southern thing about monuments and how they see the monuments as being related to that lost cause. And I think that's what Trump was getting at, but getting at it in a very distorted and weird and unsavory way, in that he's encouraging people to feel this division about it. But you know, the whole issue of the Confederate flag that begins when we're looking at Dylann Roof in Charleston, and we've been going from there since 2015 and talking about this. And I think there are the monuments and the statues, and then there are the flags. And the flag issue is somewhat of a separate issue. Because the flag has all of the symbolism that the individual monuments don't necessarily have.
So the remarks that were made yesterday on it, and I'm just wondering, this is open for everybody, but would we have taken them differently had he not said what he said on Tuesday? Do you know what I mean? It seemed like it was a left-right hook.
Yeah, I think it was an obvious attempt by the president to change the conversation, which he often wants to do, and maybe have a little bit of a better, higher ground talking about preserving history and culture, as opposed to lifting up the message of white supremacists and Nazis. I think it was taken differently, and I also think it was another maneuver by him to further divide people. Right. This is a moment when we need all our elected and unelected leaders to bring our communities together, and he went for another division.
I thought he was mainly concerned with the beauty of our parks.
His beautiful statues.
And yes, if you look at his own buildings,
developers love parks and statues.
But I see it a little bit differently, Judith, which is I don't think you have to even get that sophisticated about. I think he was listening to Bannon, and he was going directly to his base.
Right.
And he was saying, that's how I won last time, that's how I'm going to win this time, and heck with everybody else. He's wrong, of course, because his antics have energized huge numbers of people who stayed out the last time. But that's what he believes, and that's what he's being told, and that's why Bannon is still sitting in the White House.
He's still standing. I think the monument thing definitely had Bannon's fingerprints on it.
Yeah.
He may be misjudging the people, though, who are supporting preserving the monuments and not taking down the flag. Yeah, I was saying to Jill when we were talking about this, it's a kind of continuum. I'm from the South, and you know, there is that radical neo-Nazi KKK violence group, and then there are the people who don't think of themselves as racist, even though they're involved in this kind of institutionalized system, you know, historically dating back to the 17th century of African Americans having a very different heritage. And but you know, they see this differently, like the debate about taking down the Confederate flag in my hometown of Danville, the Confederate flag hanging in front of the last Capitol that is now a museum. You know, there are people who, when they talk about it, there's the Virginia flaggers, that's what they're calling themselves. They, because you can't in Danville now have Confederate flags on city property, on a city flagpole. They have actually placed flags on private property. They have a large flag just outside Danville, one of the largest in the country, I'm told, 30 foot by 50, I think is the dimensions. And this group has been putting flags all around the state. I think they have like 26 flags now. And the people who support the flag and believe they're doing so because of heritage and who are not KKK or neo-Nazi and may have some limits in terms of their support for the president, even though he's talking about monuments and a flag, as sooner or later they may reach the tipping point where he's going to lose that group.
Interesting. Interesting. You know, for a while there, I thought I had been flying an American flag for a long time because I really didn't want the right-wing group to say this is our symbol. It's not their symbol. It's our symbol as a group. And I did not want to let them get away with that. So that the American flag had become for a while, you know, you took a look at some right-wingers' house in Great Barrington, and the bigger the flag, you know, the better. I think flags, you're quite right, Frankie, flags become so symbolic of what people are thinking.
Yeah, and the symbolism is that with the Confederate flag, you know, the Confederate States of America's main ideology was slavery, and that all people are not created equal, and that flag stands for a very un-American idea.
Sure.
And you can't disentangle one from the other.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But the problem with that flag is that it's become a part of American popular culture.
What do you mean?
It's been sanitized to the extent that, if you remember the Dukes of Hazzard, and that...
Yeah.
I mean, it's become something that someone might buy,
people
see it as, they don't put it in historical context, particularly some of the young people who they should at this point. But when they think about it, they think about it as symbolizing heritage and symbolizing spirit and you know, bravery and fighting spirit and all of that. And so they detach it from the historical meaning.
Yeah,
and it goes back to the lack of education about the historical meaning.
You know, I feel that way about Hogan's Heroes, you know, on the television.
Whoever thought that was a good idea?
I mean,
how did that get past a committee? Oh, we're going to do a situation comedy at a concentration camp.
And we're going to make this, German sergeant a sort of a well-meaning but screwed-up guy.
And also, I mean, that was 19. It was in the 60s.
Yeah,
I mean, that wasn't that long.
It wasn't.
No.
It wasn't. But back to the flag, although I could talk too much TV with the best of them. Let's do Brady Bunch. But back to the flag, I'd love to hear from Nikki Haley, who really stepped up in a significant way. I think she took her action after the tragedy in Charleston, South Carolina, when she was governor. I think that really prompted her to rethink her position. And she's been silent over the last few days. And I think we want to hear where she is on all of this.
Well, she's in a difficult position.
Let's go to some letters as we...
Okay.
Our final 10
minutes. Rob says, which you were right, but for all your collective wisdom and experience, this is likely not the beginning of the end for Trump. Charlottesville may be in the rearview mirror in a week or two, particularly if North Korea coincidentally flares up again. Rob, could be right. Kathy says, "Dear panel, what are your feelings about the possibility of Trump resigning?" Thank you, Kathy. I think that's the last thing that's going to happen.
No, he can never
unless, do that. Unless, like Nixon, he sees that impeachment is inevitable.
Or Bob Mueller investigation coming
at him.
Yeah,
that's what I'm talking about. Yeah, sure. Sean wants to know, how about a statue commemorating black liberation? Are there any in the Capitol area? How does one run for Congress? These turkeys need to get out of there pronto. Well, you know, Sean, an awful lot of people are running in these primaries. I mean, I don't know what we're up to with John Faso.
I think around nine.
It's only like nine.
Yeah, nine Democrats in a Democratic primary. I appreciate the suggestion, how do you run for Congress, but also think about how do you run for city council? How do you run for school board? You can get elected to those positions without having to raise massive sums of money, and that's the barrier for many who may throw their hat in the ring on congressional, is how do you match the Mercer money, which Faso seems to have easy access to?
Well, there are a lot of people, Judith, who want you to put your money where your mouth is.
And they want you to run
for Congress. You know, I hear it all the time. We're not allowed to endorse anybody here, your response to that?
Yeah, I'm not running. I'm working on a lot on global climate change. And to be honest, you know, I think there are a lot of other really good people who can run. I know it's a little hypocritical. I want to urge other people to run. I want to stay focused on climate change. That is kind of a big issue. And I think I have a unique skill set to tackle that. But I want to encourage lots of people to run, but also think of local office.
Okay, so we heard from Brad, who says, the barriers you keep mentioning are called bollards. I work for a company that builds them, amongst other things. New York City has spent hundreds of millions in the past 10 years erecting bollards all over the five boroughs, and that's from Brad of Breakwell Steel Fabricators. Interesting letter. You never know what you're going to hear here, right? Okay.
The bollard lobby.
And James says, we shouldn't forget that Trump won the presidency just a few weeks after the Access Hollywood tape came out. There aren't a lot of polls yet, but the few have shown that the Republicans aren't abandoning Trump en masse because of his Confederate comments yet. Let's also not forget that the news cycle will continue. The news cycle, it should say. Are people going to care about these comments or even remember them by Christmas? Steve Bannon seemed pretty confident that this is the issue that Democrats will lose on. And he said so. Identity politics, he said, give me all you can, unquote.
Could be right.
Yeah.
Yeah, read the American Prospect interview with Bannon, where he makes believe that he thought it was off the record. It was quite
He's too savvy to realize that wasn't going to be off the record. And
right.
I think I think there's some weird machinations he's going through. I don't know what his objective
is. And remember, he called
them.
He called them, not the other way around.
He invited the reporter who he's never met into the White House. The reporter said, I'm away on vacation. And then he gets a phone call. But I think Bannon is, you know, lobbying for his job. And the president likes people who defend them publicly. And he is strategically just figuring out how to survive.
The president is absolutely sure that it was Bannon who got him elected president of the United States, no matter what he said.
Mm-hmm. But didn't he disagree about North Korea, though? I found that kind of interesting.
Hey, let's focus on that. Here's something I agree with Steve Bannon on. It was just last Friday we were all here talking about the continuing threat in North Korea, and Bannon overruled the military and said that military options need to be off the table because you cannot have a nuclear war. I agree with Steve Bannon. Mark the date.
Richard says, panel, does Donald Trump realize that those wonderful statues of Confederates that he is so enamored with are all losers in capital L-O-S-E-R-S? Well, there are some people who would tell you that some of these states are still fighting that war.
Well, yeah, I mean, this
subversively and less overtly, but you know, whether it's the war on drugs being ramped up or welfare reform, all of those are inherently racist. So yeah, they're still fighting the war. They're just doing it under very different pretenses now.
And Frankie, you were going to say?
No, sorry.
I was just going to say they're losers, but to many people who are still fighting that war, they're heroes in the lost cause. I mean, the Yankees, the Northerners, are the people who came into the South and destroyed it. And, you know, so those are the people who fought the good fight, even though they lost.
And they used to be Democrats, with a capital D.
Yes.
And then when Lyndon Johnson really passed the Voter Rights Act, that was the end. He turned around to people and said, that's the end of the South for us.
Right.
And he, you know, you can say whatever you want about Lyndon Johnson and Vietnam and everything, but he did some important work.
Yeah, good time to pay attention to Bill Moyers and Moyers' description of how LBJ said the Democrats have lost the South now for a very long time.
Well, I think what he was really saying is, I have lost the South now.
Well, he has, but I think he also rightly predicted the whole Democratic Party.
But
well,
if he had, I'm sorry, Frank.
No, I was just going to say, I think the Democrats could get the South back. The South is not only the neo-Nazis and KKK. There are many progressive people in the South. In my hometown of Danville, they are reimagining that city. They're trying to diversify, bring in more people. And so there are many selves. There's not just one. There's the upper self and the lower self. There's the progressive self and the self that is still fighting the war. So I think they could get the self back. They just have to have a strategy that takes all of that into account.
Well, you know, that's true. And one of the other things to keep your eye on is urban versus suburban and rural, because the urban centers are certainly the place where progressivism is reemerging.
Well, and I think that's why these dreadful people last week targeted Charlottesville, because it was
a wonderful college town.
Yeah.
John says, yes, the news has the responsibility to report on terror attacks, but does it have the responsibility to obsess over them? Is the wall-to-wall, hour-after-hour video recycling over and over again responsible journalism? I mean, there are other important things going on, says John. However, if you think about it, all you have to do to understand this, folks, is to put yourself in the news director's seat and ask yourself this. An hour after this happens, is he going to have a job if he decides to handle something else?
Yeah, people will turn the channel and go to the channel that has
and,
it on.
And the moment that happens, you're out of a job. Mm-hmm. Doug says, you are confusing two separate groups. Antifa is a group that has existed since World War II. They're especially opposed to Nazis. Many countries like Germany have completely banned Nazis. The civil rights movement was fighting for voting rights, etc. Very different issues. Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, I don't know. Yeah. All right, here we go. Lynn says, the Nazis fought the trade unionists in the streets in Munich and Berlin. What I've learned from that is that you must stop them before they take over the legal system. This is not a kumbaya moment. We must fight back on their level. And I only can say about Kumbaya, it's a song I've always loved, and I resent it when anybody always denigrates it. Okay, and here we go. Cassandra says, did you hear that Heather Heyer's mother is refusing to take Trump's calls because he equated her daughter with neo-Nazis and white supremacists? When asked if she had anything to say to Trump, she said, think before you speak. Mm. Nice. And I do think...
That's tough when you don't have a functioning brain.
You know what, Aaron? I think he does think before he speaks. I think that he has a philosophy, and his philosophy is like, get that 33%, keep the other people down so that they don't vote in elections. I win again, the same way I won the last time.
We have time for one letter, one letter.
Yes, you're right. Trump destroyed Deco's sculptures in New York City on New York City Bonwit Teller Building, even though he had promised them to the Met Museum, decided too time-consuming to save them, and that's from
Jim. Yeah, it would be a 10-day delay on his construction schedule.
Well, we all know what can happen in 10 days.
Yep.
Certainly have learned what can happen in 10 days, haven't we?
And above all, you want to avoid bankruptcy, which he knows all about.
Aaron Pacitti, thank you very much for being with us. Frankie
Thanks.
Bailey, what a wonderful pleasure having you on.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you'll come back. Lovely to have you back. Judith, see you next Friday. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Alan, we'll do this again on Monday.
We will.
All right. Have a beautiful weekend, everybody. Stay tuned now for the Phil Donahue special, and have a great weekend. We'll be back right after this.